This is Medieval Death Trip for Saturday, December 14th, 2024, episode 111, concerning conjoined twins, some incorruptibles, and royal murders. Hello and welcome to Medieval Death Trip, the show where we explore the wit and weirdness of medieval texts. I'm your host, Patrick Lane. In our last episode, we heard from Ralph of Cogshall and William of Newburgh concerning some assorted prodigies, particularly the famous Green Children of Woolpit. Still famous, it seems, largely because of Ralph and William's accounts. Both Ralph and William presented the Green Children as what we might call a pure marvel, an inexplicable occurrence that elicits awe and wonder and resists interpretation or understanding. As William tells us, quote, "I have been compelled to believe and wonder over a matter which I was unable to comprehend or unravel by any powers of intellect," end quote. We're going to start this episode by examining the place of marvels in medieval texts and the wonder they produced, and then move on to see a slightly different use case for a marvel story. Carolyn Walker Bynum outlined some of the varieties of discourse on wonder in the Middle Ages in her essay, Wonder, from her excellent 2005 book, Metamorphosis and Identity. She focuses on writers from the 12th century on, though the seeds of much of this can be found back in the 5th century with Augustine of Hippo. Among university scholars and philosophers, she says, wonder, or admiratio, was often associated with the limits of our knowledge. We wonder at things that we can't understand. And indeed, once we understand them, or they become familiar, they cease to elicit true wonder. Implicit in this approach is a categorical distinction between marvels and miracles, a distinction not observed by all medieval writers, however. But the idea is that marvels are typically natural phenomena that we don't understand. Miracles are categorically supernatural and are only possible through God overturning natural laws. Medieval theologians and mystics encounter wonder in the contemplation of the divine, and wonder is contrasted less with knowledge and more with action, which makes sense if you think of religion as less a body of knowledge and more a code of conduct, guidelines for living. So there are certain things that Christ and the saints do that we should strive to imitate or embody in our own lives, but there are other feats, whether performing miracles or engaging in extreme asceticism or embracing martyrdom, that we are not meant to emulate ourselves, but instead wonder at. And this ties into the development of devotional practices like the mysteries of the rosary or the stations of the cross, where you're meant to meditate on these wondrous moments. Now, of course, we do find today churches of signs and wonders, so-called snake-handling churches, where, essentially, it is expected that everybody will be performing miracles, whether snake handling or speaking in tongues or laying on hands or what have you. But the medieval church, a feudal and hierarchical church, certainly didn't propose that everyone is meant to be a wonder-working saint. So this discourse of wonder provided a way for Christians to process saints as role models and compartmentalize what was feasible and desirable to emulate and what perhaps makes for an inspiring story, but is not what you want your kids doing. A third category is the wonder elicited by hearing the marvels reported by travelers to distant lands or dark corners of the local region, or those collected by historians, like Ralph of Cogshall and William of Newburgh, or today's author, William of Malmesbury, though he's also going to put on the mantle of hagiographer in this selection. For the historians in particular, part of the emphasis in sharing marvels is wondering at their factuality, that these singular events really happened and are worth remembering, even if we don't necessarily understand what they mean. There is often an anxiety for these writers about showing that the account is credible and not false. We saw that quite plainly with both of our writers last episode, citing their sources and witnesses for the Green Children narrative. And for both historians and travel writers, there is a tendency to focus on otherness in marvels, illustrating a distance between us and them, or here and there. And we saw that too with the Green Children, who came from another place fundamentally different from England, and who were physically and culturally different. And the Green Girl's ultimate integration into English society involved losing both the physical difference of her unusual color and learning to speak English. And many miracle healing stories involve someone who experiences something mind-blowing and then has to keep going about their life afterwards, testifying to this amazing thing that once happened to them while they have reverted to once again being just a farmer who the hagiographer confidently tells us was living in the village just a few years ago. Indeed, marvels that don't become mundane are almost obligated to be either something found in a faraway land or something which occurred at a singular moment in the past also being a form of foreign country that we cannot easily visit. Or, if not either of those, then at a minimum, it has to be unpredictable. For example, a saint shrine might dispense miracle cures to those who lick up the water that seeps from the stone, but only some people actually get a cure sometimes. If the marvelous were truly regular and reliable, it would cease to amaze us. Think about how ordinary air travel feels to us, or look at AI-generated photos. Despite some of their notable shortcomings and ethically dubious sourcing, they were kind of amazing for those first couple of years, and now they're already passé. They are so unmarvelous, they are now actually spam. As an aside, I also think this kind of explains a low-key crisis in modern blockbuster filmmaking. It is so hard for special effects spectacle to make us wonder anymore. Bringing a never-before-seen monster to fully animated life on screen is now almost as passé as AI-generated fashion models. I remember going to see Jurassic Park in the theaters in 1993, and a major part of the sales pitch for the movie was that you will see dinosaurs brought back to life in ways you never dreamed possible. It was almost as compelling as John Hammond's fictional sales pitch for genetically resurrecting real dinosaurs. Ignoring the story and the characters, a big reason to see the movie at all was just to wonder at the special effects. And I don't think that's really possible anymore for cinematic special effects. The idea that you'll see something impossible brought to life on screen is now mundane. Your neighbor's kid can make Jurassic Park effects on their home computer. And for my generation, this was also true for video games. Even games with weak gameplay, you would play for hours just to wonder at new advances in graphics. And now, the appeal of realistic graphics seems to have mostly plateaued, so much so that retro graphics and pixel art are surging back into fashion. Now, there's an upside to this death of wonder for both film and games, in that there can be more focus on storytelling and performance, and for games, mechanics and gameplay, rather than on special effects and graphics. And that's good for both art forms. But culturally, it does leave me wondering. Where does the current younger generation experience wonder? If the world can already match the images that are in your imagination, if there's no gap between what you can imagine and what you can see, how does that not make the world feel stagnant and boring? Or maybe that's utopia. Maybe that's Willy Wonka's world.
But Charlie, don't forget what happened to the man who suddenly got everything he always wanted.
What happened?
He lived happily ever after.
So maybe I'm the old crank saying, back in my day, we never believed we'd see Tolkien's world brought realistically and lovingly to life on screen, or that we'd ever see a live-action Incredible Hulk that wasn't a bodybuilder in green makeup and a bad wig. And that built character, by gum.
Why, there are no children here at the 4-H Club either. Am I so out of touch? No, it's the children who are wrong.
Anyway, Bynum highlights a good passage from Gervase of Tilbury, the 12th century author of the Otia Imperialia, that sums up a remarkably practical and psychologically astute framework of wonder, again with examples pilfered from Augustine. Here is Gervase from the preface to Book 3 of the Otia Imperialia, as translated by S.E. Banks and J.W. Binns. For we reckon that things are adjudged novelties on four criteria: for their originality, or their recentness, or their rarity, or their strangeness. So anything that is newly created gives pleasure by reason of the working of nature, Anything that has only just happened causes excitement, less if it happens often, more if it is rare. When anything strange is observed, we seize on it, partly because of the inversion of the natural order, which surprises us, partly because of our ignorance of the cause, whose working is a mystery to us, and partly because of seeing our expectation cheated in unfamiliar circumstances of which we lack a proper understanding. From these causes arise two things, miracles and marvels, though they both result in wonderment. Now, we generally call those things miracles, which, being preternatural, we ascribe to divine power, as when a virgin gives birth, when Lazarus is raised from the dead, or when diseased limbs are made whole again. While we call those things marvels, which are beyond our comprehension, even though they are natural. In fact, the inability to explain why a thing is so constitutes a marvel. For instance, it is a matter of common knowledge that the salamander lives in fire, and although fire is of a destructive nature, this creature is nourished by it, not destroyed. I myself saw, when I was lately in Rome, a strap of salamander skin about the size of a belt, which had been brought there by the Cardinal Master Peter of Capua. When it had picked up some dirt from being handled, it was put into a fire, and before our eyes the fire cleansed it of every stain, but did not burn it at all. The infernal mountains of Sicily also offer quite sufficient proof that not all that burns is destroyed. Throughout the ages, from time immemorial up to the present, they have been seething with flames, and seem likely to continue, and yet they remain undamaged. Likewise, souls show that not everything that can suffer can also die. We should be similarly impressed by what we see daily displayed to view in the case of lime, which catches fire if it is sprinkled with cold water, though all other things are cooled by contact with cold water, while it is not warmed if oil is poured on, though oil fosters fire. If all these things were told of some Indian stone of which we could have no first-hand knowledge, we should surely judge them to be false, or at least we should be overcome with awed amazement. But because the evidence for these things is set before our eyes every day, they are held of no account, not because they are of a less marvelous character, but simply because we see them so often. And so it happens that we are quick to marvel at many things from India, just because it is a distant part of the world. But when it has been possible for these things to be brought over to us, they have appeared less wonderful. Therefore, no one should take the things we write to be idle tales, for our purpose in assembling them has not been to weary your venerable hearing with empty words, but the wish that, laying aside the lying fictions of players which are mingled with a small amount of truth, you may learn of marvels of which mere storytellers have no knowledge, on reliable testimony deriving from the lands where they occur, or from writers who can vouch for them. So, that's Gervase of Tilbury explaining how marvels produce wonder. A quick note, the salamander skin, he observed, was possibly a bit of silk fabric, or, more likely, asbestos fabric, which was produced in the East, at Persia, India, China, early in the first millennium. But not all marvels and novelties were treated as mere objects of wonder. Just because you can't explain how something happens doesn't mean you can't take a stab at why it happens. As I said earlier, our marvels from last episode, especially the Green Children, have our chroniclers remarking on how, in this case, not only can they not make much sense of what happened, they can't even begin to interpret them either. This is the less common case. Often, certain kinds of wondrous phenomena are perceived as vessels of meaning, as messages from the divine. This is when marvels become omens, portents, and, in the classical sense, monsters. As we're about to hear, the word monster comes from Latin monstrum, meaning a divine omen or sign, which itself comes from the verb monere, to warn, to admonish, to remind, and which we can find another derivative of in modern English in demonstrate, to show something. And in addition to meteorological and astronomical and seismic wonders, as well as prophetic dreams and apparitions, this is one of the biggest categories of portent: physical difference and unusual births. which makes sense if you consider that it was probably one of the more commonly experienced marvels in an age of pre-modern medicine and household animal husbandry. As a medieval peasant, you're fairly likely over your lifetime to see some births and stillbirths among livestock and sometimes people that are startlingly unusual. We're going to encounter this type of medieval monster at the beginning of our selection for today from William of Malmesbury, who, unlike Ralph of Coggeshall or William of Newburgh, has no qualms about launching into an interpretation of what a particular physical difference signifies in pretty specific political terms. But first, let's get the hermeneutic framework, the interpretive system that William is working in, from one of our great explainers, Isidore of Seville, who finds his vehicle for explaining the world through word origins, a man very close to my own heart. So, here is the discussion of portents and prodigies from Book 11 of Isidore's Etymologies, written in the early 7th century, as translated by Barney, Lewis, Beach, and Berghoff. Varro defines portents as beings that seem to have been born contrary to nature. But they are not contrary to nature, because they are created by divine will, since the nature of everything is the will of the Creator. Whence, even the pagans address God sometimes as nature, natura, sometimes as God. A portent is therefore not created contrary to nature, but contrary to what is known nature. Portents are also called signs, omens, and prodigies because they are seen to portend and display, indicate and predict future events. The term portent, portentum, is said to be derived from foreshadowing, portendere, that is, from showing beforehand, preostendere. Signs, ostendum, because they seem to show, ostendere, a future event. Prodigies, prodigium, are so called because they speak hereafter, poro dicere, that is, they predict the future. But omens, monstrum, derive their name from admonition, monitus, because in giving a sign they indicate, demonstrare, something, or else because they instantly show, monstrare, what may appear. And this is its proper meaning, even though it has frequently been corrupted by the improper use of writers. Some portents seem to have been created as indications of future events, for God sometimes wants to indicate what is to come through some defects in newborns, and also through dreams and oracles, by which he may foreshadow and indicate future calamity for certain peoples or individuals, as is indeed proved by abundant experience. In fact, to Xerxes, a fox born of a mare was a portent for the destruction of the empire. A monster to which a woman gave birth, whose upper body parts were human but dead, while its lower body parts came from diverse animals yet were alive, signified to Alexander the sudden murder of the king, for the worse parts had outlived the better ones. However, those monsters that are produced as omens do not live long. They die as soon as they are born. There is a difference between a portent, portentum, and an unnatural being, portentuosus. Portents are beings of transformed appearance, as, for instance, is said to have happened when in Umbria a woman gave birth to a serpent, whence Lucan says, "And the child terrified its own mother." But an unnatural being, strictly speaking, takes the form of a slight mutation, as, for instance, in the case of someone born with six fingers. Portents, then, or unnatural beings, exist in some cases in the form of a size of the whole body that surpasses common human nature, as in the case of Tityos, who, as Homer witnesses, covered 9 jugers, or about 6 acres, when lying prostrate. In other cases, in the form of a smallness of the whole body, as in dwarfs, nonos, or those whom the Greeks call pygmies, pygmaios, because they are a cubit tall. Others are so called due to the size of parts of their bodies, as for instance a misshapen head, or due to superfluous parts of their limbs, as in the case of 2-headed and 3-headed individuals, or in the case of cynodontes, dog-toothed people, who have a pair of projecting fangs. Yet others are so-called due to missing parts of the body, individuals in whom one corresponding part is deficient compared with the other, as when one hand is compared with the other hand and one foot with the other foot. Others due to a cutting off, as in the case of those born without a hand or without a head, whom the Greeks call stereisios, from stereisis, deprivation. Others in the form of praenomeria, when only the head or a leg is born. So, there you have Isidore focused on the supernatural implications of physical difference, but in practice offering us a rather comprehensive medical catalog. I do find it kind of funny how nearly everything in this discussion of prophetic portents and prodigies is specific to bodily differences, but he throws in there in one line, "Oh, it can also be dreams and oracles," though that's also a product of the structure of the etymologies. This discussion occurs in Book 11, which is all about terms relating to human beings and their bodies. So he covers other marvels elsewhere, such as comets as omens of political change, which we heard about in Episode 35, concerning some astronomical anomalies and meteorological marvels. And now, let's turn to William of Malmesbury's Gesta Regum Anglorum. This little series of marvels we're about to hear occurs within a larger kind of rhapsody that precedes his narrative of the death of Edward the Confessor and the succession crisis that ends in the Norman conquest. Before he gets lost in that big story, he takes a moment to look back over the royal saints of the Anglo-Saxon period to kind of refurbish the reputation of the Anglo-Saxons before narrating their collapse. So when he says, "at that time," at the start of this excerpt, he means roughly around the year 1065. But as you'll see, he will go on to dip further back into the timeline of Anglo-Saxon England for others of his examples. We're also not starting at the absolute beginning of this catalog of marvels, the story of the Witch of Berkeley, for example, which we heard in episode 97 concerning three witches, occurs just a few pages before today's passage as an earlier anecdote in this larger catalog. So, here is William of Malmesbury as translated by J.A. Giles. At that time, too, on the confines of Brittany and Normandy, a prodigy was seen in one, or more properly speaking, in two women. There were two heads, four arms, and every other part twofold to the navel. Beneath were two legs, two feet, and all other parts single. While one was laughing, eating, or speaking, the other would cry, fast, or remain silent. Though both mouths ate, yet the excrement was discharged by only one passage. At last, one dying, the other survived, and the living carried about the dead for the space of 3 years, till she died also through the fatigue of the weight and the stench of the dead carcass. Many were of opinion, and some have even written, that these women represented England and Normandy, which, though separated by position, are yet united under one master. Whatever wealth these countries greedily absorb flows into one common receptacle, which is either the covetousness of princes or the ferocity of surrounding nations. England, yet vigorous, supports with her wealth Normandy, now dead and almost decayed, until she herself perhaps shall fall through the violence of spoilers. Happy if she shall ever again breathe that liberty, the mere shadow of which she has long pursued. She now mourns, borne down with calamity and oppressed with exactions, the causes of which misery I shall relate after I have dispatched some things pertaining to my subject. For since I have hitherto recorded the civil and military transactions of the kings of England, I may be allowed to expatiate somewhat on the sanctity of certain of them, and at the same time to contemplate what splendor of divine love beamed on this people from the first dawning of their faith, since I believe you can nowhere find the bodies of so many saints entire after death, typifying the state of final incorruption. I imagine this to have taken place by God's agency in order that a nation, situated, as it were, almost out of the world, should more confidently embrace the hope of a resurrection from the contemplation of the incorruption of the saints. There are, altogether, five which I have known of, though the residents in many places boast of more. St. Etheldreda and Werburga, virgins, King Edmund, Archbishop Elfege, Cuthbert the Ancient Father, who, with skin and flesh unwasted and their joints flexible, appear to have a certain vital warmth about them and to be merely sleeping. Who can enumerate all the other saints of different ranks and professions whose names and lives singly to describe I have neither intention nor leisure? Yet, oh, that I might hereafter have leisure! But I will be silent, lest I should seem to promise more than I can perform. In consequence, it is not necessary to mention any of the commonalty, but merely, not to go out of the path of my subject history, the male and female scions of the royal stock, most of them innocently murdered, and who have been consecrated martyrs, not by human conjecture, but by divine acknowledgement. Hence may be known how little indulgence they gave to the lust of pleasure who inherited eternal glory by means of so easy a death. In the former book, my history dwelt for some time on the praises of the Most Holy Oswald, king and martyr, among whose other marks of sanctity was this, which, according to some copies, is related in the history of the Angles of Bede. In the monastery at Selsey, which Wilfrid of holy memory had tilled with Northumbrian monks, a dreadful malady broke out and destroyed numbers. The remainder endeavored to avert the pestilence by a fast of 3 days. On the second day of the fast, the blessed apostles Peter and Paul, appearing to a youth who was sick with the disorder, animated him by observing that he should not fear approaching death, as it would be a termination of his present illness and an entrance into eternal life, that no other person of that monastery would die of this disorder, because God had granted this to the merits of the noble King Oswald, who was that very day supplicating for his countrymen. For it was on this day that the king, murdered by the faithless, had in a moment ascended to the heavenly tribunal, that they should search, therefore, in the scroll in which the names of the dead were written, and if they found it so, they should put an end to the fast, give loose to security and joy, and sing solemn masses to God and to the holy king. This vision being quickly followed by the death of the boy, and the anniversary of the martyr being found in the martyrology, and at the same time the cessation of the disorder being attested by the whole province, the name of Oswald was from that period inserted among the martyrs, which before, on account of his recent death, had only been admitted to the list of the faithful. Deservedly, I say, then deservedly is he to be celebrated, whose glory the divine approbation so signally manifested, as to order him to be dignified with masses, in a manner, as I think, not usual among men. The undoubted veracity of the historian Bede precludes the possibility of supposing this matter to be false, as does the blessed Bishop Acca, who was the friend of the author. Egbert, King of Kent, the son of Erkenbert, whom I have mentioned before, had some very near relations descended from the royal line. Their names were Ethelred and Ethelbert, the sons of Ermenred, his uncle. Apprehensive that they might grow up with notions of succeeding to the kingdom, and fearful for his safety, he kept them about him for some time with very homely entertainment, and, at last, grudging them his regards, he removed them from his court. Soon after, when they had been secretly dispatched by one of his servants named Thunra, which signifies thunder, he buried them under heaps of rubbish, thinking that a murder perpetrated in privacy would escape detection. The eye of God, however, which no secrets of the heart can deceive, brought the innocents to light, vouchsafing many cures upon the spot, until the neighbors, being roused, dug up the unsightly heaps of turf and rubbish cast upon the bodies, and forming a trench after the manner of a sepulchre, they erected a small church over it. There they remained till the time of King Edgar, when they were taken up by St. Oswald, Archbishop of Worcester, and conveyed to the monastery of Ramsey, from which period, granting the petitions of the suppliant, they have manifested themselves by many miracles. Offa, king of the Mercians, murdered many persons of consequence for the security, as he supposed, of his kingdom, without any distinction of friend or foe. Among these was King Ethelbert, thereby being guilty of an atrocious outrage against the suitor of his daughter. His unmerited death, however, is thought to have been amply avenged by the short reign of Offa's son. Indeed, God signalized his sanctity by such evident tokens that at this very day the Episcopal Church of Hereford is consecrated to his name. Nor should anything appear idle or irrelevant which our pious and religious ancestors have either tolerated by their silence or confirmed by their authority. What shall my pen here trace worthy of St. Kenelm, a youth of tender age? Kenulf, king of the Mercians, his father, had consigned him, when 7 years old, to his sister Quindrida, for the purpose of education. But she, falsely entertaining hopes of the kingdom for herself, gave her little brother in charge to a servant of her household, with an order to dispatch him. Taking out the innocent, under pretense of hunting for his amusement or recreation, he murdered and hid him in a thicket. But, strange to tell, the crime which had been so secretly committed in England gained publicity in Rome by God's agency, for a dove from heaven bore a parchment scroll to the altar of St. Peter containing an exact account both of his death and place of burial. As this was written in the English language, it was vainly attempted to be read by the Romans and men of other nations who were present. Fortunately, however, and opportunely, an Englishman was at hand who translated the writing to the Roman people into Latin and gave occasion to the Pope to write a letter to the kings of England acquainting them with the martyrdom of their countrymen. In consequence of this, the body of the innocent was taken up in presence of a numerous assembly and removed to Winchcombe. The murderous woman was so indignant at the vocal chant of the priests and loud applause of the laity that she thrust out her head from the window of the chamber where she was standing and, by chance, having in her hands a psalter, she came in course of reading to the psalm, "O God, my praise," which, for I know not what charm, reading backwards, she endeavored to drown the joy of the choristers. At that moment, her eyes, torn by divine vengeance from their hollow sockets, scattered blood upon the verse which runs, "This is the work of them who defame me to the Lord and who speak evil against my soul." The marks of her blood are still extant, proving the cruelty of the woman and the vengeance of God. The body of the little saint is very generally adored, and there is hardly any place in England more venerated, or where greater numbers of persons attend the festival, and this arising from the long-continued belief of his sanctity and the constant exhibition of miracles. Nor shall my history be wanting in thy praise, Wisten, blessed youth, son of Wiemund, son of Wythlof, king of the Mercians, and of Elfleda, daughter of Ceolwulf, who was the uncle of Kenelm. I will not, I say, pass thee over in silence, whom Berfert, thy relation, so atrociously murdered. And let posterity know, if they deem this history worthy of perusal, that there was nothing earthly more praiseworthy than your disposition, at which a deadly assassin, becoming irritated, dispatched you. Nor was there anything more innocent than your purity towards God, invited by which the secret judge deemed it fitting to honor you, for a pillar of light, sent down from heaven, piercing the sable robe of night, revealed the wickedness of the deep cavern, and brought to view the crime of the murderer. In consequence, Wiston's venerable remains were taken up, and by the care of his relations conveyed to Reppendum, at that time a famous monastery, now a villa belonging to the Earl of Chester, and its glory grown obsolete with age. But at present thou dwellest at Evesham, kindly favoring the petitions of such as regard thee. Bede has related many anecdotes of the sanctity of the kings of the East Saxons and East Angles, whose genealogy I have in the first book of this work traced briefly, because I could nowhere find a complete history of the kings. I shall, however, dilate somewhat on St. Edmund, who held dominion in East Anglia, and to whom the time of Bede did not extend. This province, on the south and east, is surrounded by the ocean, on the north by deep lakes and stagnant pools, which, stretching out a vast distance in length, with a breadth of 2 or 3 miles, afford abundance of fish for the use of the inhabitants. On the west, it is continuous with the rest of the island, but defended by the earths being thrown up in the form of a rampart. The soil is admirable for pasture and for hunting. It is full of monasteries, and large bodies of monks are settled on the islands of these stagnant waters. The people are a merry, pleasant, jovial race, though apt to carry their jokes to excess. Here, then, reigned Edmund, a man devoted to God, ennobled by his descent from ancient kings, and though he presided over the province in peace for several years, yet never through the effeminacy of the times did relax his virtue. Hingwar and Hubba, two leaders of the Danes, came over to depopulate the provinces of the Northumbrians and East Angles. The former of these seized the unresisting king, who had cast away his arms and was lying on the ground in prayer, and after the infliction of tortures, beheaded him. On the death of this saintly man, the purity of his past life was evidenced by unheard-of miracles. The Danes had cast away the head, when severed from the body by the cruelty of the executioners, and it had been hidden in a thicket. While his subjects, who had tracked the footsteps of the enemy as they departed, were seeking it, intending to solemnize with due honor the funeral rites of their king, they were struck with the pleasing intervention of God. For the lifeless head uttered a voice, inviting all who were in search of it to approach. A wolf, a beast accustomed to prey upon dead carcasses, was holding it in its paws and guarding it untouched, which animal also, after the manner of a tame creature, gently followed the bearers to the tomb and neither did nor received any injury. The sacred body was then for a time committed to the earth. Turf was placed over it and a wooden chapel of trifling cost erected. The negligent natives, however, were soon made sensible of the virtue of the martyr, which excited their listless minds to reverence him by the miracles which he performed. And though perhaps the first proof of his power may appear weak and trivial, yet nevertheless I shall subjoin it. He bound, with invisible bands, some thieves who had endeavored to break into the church by night. This was done in the very attempt, a pleasant spectacle enough to see the plunder hold fast the thief, so that he could neither desist from the enterprise nor complete the design. In consequence, Theodred, Bishop of London, who lies at St. Paul's, removed the lasting disgrace of so mean a structure by building a nobler edifice over those sacred limbs, which evidenced the glory of his unspotted soul by a surprising soundness and a kind of milky whiteness. The head, which was formerly divided from the neck, is again united to the rest of the body, showing only the sign of martyrdom by a purple seam. One circumstance indeed surpasses human miracles, which is that the hair and nails of the dead man continue to grow. These, Oswin, a holy woman, used yearly to clip and cut that they might be objects of veneration to posterity. Truly, this was a holy temerity for a woman to contemplate and handle limbs superior to the whole of this world. Not so Leofstan, a youth of bold and untamed insolence, who with many impertinent threats commanded the body of the martyr to be shown to him. For he was desirous, as he said, of settling the uncertainty of report by the testimony of his own eyesight. He paid dearly, however, for his audacious experiment, for he became insane, and shortly after died, swarming with vermin. He felt indeed that Edmund was now capable of doing what he had before used to do, that is, to spare the suppliant but confound the proud, by which means he so completely engaged the inhabitants of all Britain to him that every person looked upon himself as particularly happy in contributing either money or gifts to St. Edmund's monastery. Even kings themselves, who rule others, used to boast of being his servants and sent him their royal crown, redeeming it, if they wished to use it, at a great price. The exactors of taxes also, who in other places gave loose to injustice, were there suppliant, and ceased their cavailing at St. Edmund's boundary, admonished thereto by the punishment of others who had presumed to overpass it. So, there you have some wonders and miracles from the end of the Anglo-Saxon era in Britain from William of Malmesbury. I don't actually have a whole lot to say about the bulk of the catalog here, all the royal saints. I will apologize for having cut William off just before he continues into his shorter list of female royal saints. It would be nice to include the women, but there's not much substantive there. Here's how William himself introduces that section. Quote, "My commendations shall also glance at the names of some maidens of the royal race, though I must claim indulgence for being brief upon the subject, not through fastidiousness, but because I am unacquainted with their miracles." End quote. We have talked about incorruptible saintly corpses before in episode 41 concerning the examination of Cuthbert's body, 1104. Nor do I have much to add here on the subject of murderous royal relatives. We've seen plenty of that before too. So let's roll back to where William started us with a true prodigy by the standards of Isidore of Seville. The conjoined twins that William describes are, in modern medical terminology, most likely either ischiopagus, joined at the pelvis, or pygopagus, joined at the lower spine. He doesn't give us quite enough details to precisely assign the modern designations, though both of those type of twin have relatively high modern survival rates in the 60 to 70% range. There's no reason to believe that these weren't real people. The only part that strains credulity is the statement that one twin died and the other continued to live for 3 more years. At face value, that doesn't really accord with modern medical understanding, especially for twins sharing a digestive system. This is not twins connected by just a bit of cartilage where one might die without necessarily immediately impacting the health of the other. So either the 3 years is a major exaggeration up from a few hours of the other twin surviving, an exaggeration that may be shaped to fit the political allegory. Or, if we want to give our historian a bit more credit, maybe the other twin didn't die, but suffered a stroke and was in a vegetative state for a long time until both died, which seems like a scenario that could easily get passed down as one twin died and the other had to carry the corpse for 3 years. I'm also kind of impressed by how relatively sensitive William's portrait is. For example, he specifically corrects the misconception that this is a two-headed lady. He recognizes that this is two individual women. He does present them as this allegorical object in the end, but he also doesn't show any negative judgment of them. Clearly, he experiences wonder at the report of them, but he doesn't show disgust. He doesn't demonize them. And though he doesn't really tell us anything about them beyond the nature of their physical difference, he nonetheless doesn't dehumanize them. And I think what feels like sensitivity and humanism is a result of the medieval discourse on wonder. If something instills wonder in you, if you don't understand it and it might be God trying to reveal something to you, then it's not a good look to be judgmental or disgusted or contemptuous. And we've seen a bit of this with our medieval travel writers too, from episodes 54 to 57 and in Jordanus's Wonders of the East, available to all our Patreon supporters. The medieval writers often seem less judgmental or prejudiced than their Victorian commentators, who are quite happy to view exotic weirdness as all somehow symptomatic of these savage and uncivilized fringes of the world, desperately in need of saving by the British Empire. And so perhaps there is value in that discourse of wonder. I want to conclude with a passage from Carolyn Walker Bynum that considers just that point. She concludes her essay on wonder as follows. Medieval philosophers and theologians emphasized wonder as a first step towards knowledge. We, in our postmodern anxiety, tend rather to emphasize how hard it is to know. Medieval devotional writers and hagiographers stressed wonder as the opposite of imitation or possession. We are aware that any response involves some appropriation. Medieval travelers and collectors of marvels argued that awe and dread are situated, perspectival. We share this perception and give credit to feminism and postcolonial theory for it, but we suspect that such awareness shatters the possibility of writing any coherent account of the world. Medieval chroniclers and occasional writers stressed the uniqueness of events rather than the trends they illustrated, their moral significance rather than their temporal cause. We fear that the particular is the trivial and that significance is merely the projection of our own values onto the past. Nonetheless, I would argue we write the best history when the specificity, the novelty, the awfulness of what our sources render up bowls us over with its complexity and its significance. Our research is better when we move only cautiously to understanding, when fear that we may appropriate the other leads us not so much to writing about ourselves and our fear as to crafting our stories with attentive, wondering care. At our best, we strive for the strange view of things, not least because, as Thomas Aquinas understood, admiratio has to do with teaching. I am certain my students sometimes feel that I speak to them of things as bizarre and unheard of as William of Newburgh's green children or the barnacle geese born from trees that some medieval authors allege they had seen. But surely our job as teachers is to puzzle, confuse, and amaze. We must rear a new generation of students who will gaze in wonder at texts and artifacts, quick to puzzle over a translation, slow to project or appropriate, quick to assume there is significance, slow to generalize about it. Not only as scholars then, but also as teachers, we must astonish and be astonished. For the flat, generalizing, presentist view of the past encapsulates it and makes it boring. Whereas amazement yearns towards an understanding, a significance that is always just a little beyond both our theories and our fears. Every view of things that is not wonderful is false. I'm not sure I totally believe that last sentence, but it is a kind of stirring call to an imaginative engagement with the world. And Bynum is offering one clear place we can find wonder, even if it seems to be lacking around us, just as the medieval people did themselves, and that's in moments in the past or art from the past. And that's not about wallowing in nostalgia, including nostalgia for times you never lived in, or quote-unquote living in the past. Earlier, I used the somewhat trivial examples of special effects and video game graphics as places where we seem to have lost our sense of wonder. But I worry that maybe it's more than that. I think we've lost a lot of our wonder at technology in general, at least positive wonder. Wonder can be positive or negative. Dread is also a mode of wonderment. So there may legitimately be sublime dread of certain technological developments that qualifies as modern wonder. But even dread of the singularity or nuclear apocalypse is starting to feel mundane and familiar. And it does seem to me that in a world post 9/11 and post all the military conflicts that followed, and now post Katrina and post COVID, we've even grown rather numb to atrocity and tragedy at what ought to be awe-inspiring scales. Of course, versions of this have been said for the period after World War I and the dawn of mechanized warfare, and then again after the Holocaust and the dropping of atomic bombs in World War II. Perhaps as a culture, we began growing more and more numb to atrocities throughout the 20th century and into the 21st, and it's hardly a novel development. But maybe that means we need to try to actively seek wonder, be it negative or positive. For us, unlike medieval people, it might require work and conscious effort to find and value the experience of wonder. Or it's just an example of how people have always complained about the same thing and reveals more about the complainers than the actual state of society. Hopefully, many of you do find plenty of wonder still in the world, and my anxieties can safely be written off as those of a prematurely aged crank. However, as per Bynum's call to action, I can find some wonder in old words. So we're not only going to hear our mystery word for this episode, but a few wonderful, or at least I hope delightful, bonus words as well. Our mystery word today is glop. G-L-O-P, glop. This word goes back to Middle English and persisted as a Northern British dialect word into the 19th century. Glop, or glope, means to stare, and particularly to stare in wonder or surprise. Its etymology is uncertain. Middle English gloppen meant to stare in amazement, to be startled or frightened, but also to be distressed or downcast, which hints at a likely origin. Old Norse has glupna, to be downcast, possibly cognate with Dutch kloipa, to watch slyly or sneak, and Old Swedish glupa, to gape or swallow, which appears to have taken on the modern meaning of stupid or foolish, one who stands agape. In English, we might say slack-jawed yokel.
Some vocal never is good, but then again, some vocal like Cletus, the slack-jawed yokel.
Hey, what's going on this side?
And now our bonus words, because I found glop while searching through the G's in James Orchard Hallowell's Dictionary of Archaic and Provincial Words, Obsolete Phrases, and Ancient Customs from the 14th Century, published in 1852, and there were so many good candidates. Glop fits our marvels and wonders theme, but I have to share some of the others. First up, and still appropriate for the season, migration season, is Gabriel's Hounds, which Hallowell defines as follows. Quote, "At Winsbury in Staffordshire, the colliers, going to their pits early in the morning, hear the noise of a pack of hounds in the air, to which they give the name of Gabriel's Hounds, though the more sober and judicious take them only to be wild geese making this noise in their flight." End quote. Where I am, we can hear Canada geese flying overhead regularly, especially this time of year, so it'll be fun to have another name for them. Next could also have fit our theme of prodigies. It is Galligantus, defined as any animal much above the usual size. Galligantus appears as the name of a giant in a few variations on the Jack and the Giant's tale as early as the 1700s, and I haven't been able to determine if the giant is named for this old nonsense word, or if the word comes from the name of the giant. The latter seems more likely, since it's such a common pattern, even with this particular theme of large things. For example, both Gargantuan and Jumbo derive from proper names. As we head further into the festive season, you might find occasion to use the Lincolnshire dialect word gamoddled. According to Hallowell, it means, quote, half tipsy, end quote. I'm not entirely sure what degree of inebriation half tipsy is. If tipsy is half drunk, then gamoddled might be buzzed or something. I don't know. Maybe it doesn't have a good synonym, and that's all the more reason to bring it back into circulation. That glass of eggnog left me a bit gamoddled. We have a bit of old British wit in the word goldfinder, which Hallowell defines as an old jocular name for a person who cleaned a jakes. And as we learned in episode 42, continuing the Corpse of Cuthbert series, jakes is early modern English slang for a privy or latrine, where the nuggets you find are unlikely to be gold. And finally, we have a word that gives us an interesting point of trivia. The word is goff, G-O-F-F. Hallowell defines this as, quote, "a game played by striking hard-stuffed balls with clubs. He who drives his ball into the hole with fewest strokes is the winner. It was a common game in England in the reign of James I," end quote. At first, I took this to be a lexicographer's joke, like Samuel Johnson's definition of oats, quote, "a grain which in England is generally given to horses, but in Scotland appears to support the people," end quote. Hallowell's dictionary is full of variant spellings of common words, like gint, G-I-N-T, which just means joint, so I thought he had this variant spelling of golf and had a little bit of gentleman's fun pretending it was an archaic pastime. However, while golf goes back to medieval Scotland and was popular enough there to have been banned twice by two different King Jameses for being a distraction from military exercises, these were King James II of Scotland and James IV of Scotland in the late 15th century, about 200 years later, James VII of Scotland, who became James II of England, played the first known international game of golf when he played against a pair of English courtiers in 1681. But then, golf kind of languished in popularity outside of Scotland until the second half of the 19th century, after Hallowell wrote his dictionary. So when Hallowell defined golf, or goff, as this thing of the past, and displays no awareness of what is the common spelling now, he's just testifying to how obscure golf still was to Englishmen in the mid-1800s. And that brings us to the end of this episode. In the spirit of giving thanks, I'd like to thank our newest supporter on Patreon, who goes by the name Leon Thotsky. Thank you so much, comrade. Our Patreon supporters get access to bonus audio, including the aforementioned audiobook-length recording of Jordanus's Wonders of the East, as well as occasional audio appendices to episodes. If you'd like to become a patron, you can find us on Patreon at patreon.com/mdtpodcast. You can also get lots of info at our website, medievaldeathtrip.com, where we have bibliographic references for this and every episode, as well as links to our various social media accounts, including Instagram, where I'll once again be hosting a Medieval Death Trip Advent calendar. Check in every day for a new treat. If you don't want to follow us for whatever reason, you can also find it by searching for the hashtag MDTAdvent24. In the sidebar of our website, you'll also find a link to our Spotify Christmas playlist, which contains nearly 9 hours of holiday music, mostly quasi-medieval-ish, either in origins or performance style, along with a few pieces that are just personal favorites. As I say every year, shuffle the playlist at your own risk. There are quite a few carols that appear many times. I've curated and ordered it to avoid repeats and to have at least some degree of flow from song to song. Feel free to shuffle instead, but be prepared for 3 or 4 versions of the Coventry Carol in a row. You can also find that playlist by searching Spotify for MDT Christmas, which is the playlist title. So I hope everyone's holiday season is starting off well, and remember, don't go testing St. Edmund unless you want to die insane and swarming with vermin. And thanks for listening.